we went out to the general vicinity of the last known radar contact, and we began sweeping the area with our sonar array that is capable of searching a wide area. For people who don't know a lot about sonar equipment, most sonar equipment is very narrow. You will search about a 1,500-foot section of lake bed at a time, and it takes a long time to mow, as they say, the lawn back and forth, sweeping with sonar. Ours is a wide-range sonar. It's capable of looking over a wide area. It took us basically 5 or 6 days of sweeping until we got the hit on the F-89, or what appeared to be the F-89. We didn't know until we looked at it a little closer. There was a lot of emptiness down there. You know, there weren't any wrecks in the immediate area, and so it's a lot of flat lake bottom, and you get this shape that just kind of appears out of that. So the anomaly kind of stands right out at you. And, of course, I think several of us jumped up and said, what is that? You know, back up, hold up, you know. Did we say, that's the F-89? No, we didn't know at that point until we were able to rescan with a high resolution and take some measurements.
And so then you think it's probably the F-89 from the 1953 Kinross incident. How did you then find that other mysterious object?
Well, when we went back and got the image, the high-res image of the F-89, we immediately dropped the ROV in the water to look at the F-89 to hopefully get a serial number off the tail, which was exactly what we did, and also to get visual confirmation that it was the F-89 from other things, like what type of wing pod does it have, what type of canopy does it have, anything to give us a clue that this was an F-89, and what made us focus on the object when it began causing problems with our equipment. There's just a huge story there, and not to mention the story leading up, what happened in 1953.
What were the problems with your equipment?
Well, we didn't note the object at first until we began a detailed scan, what we call a high-resolution scan of the area, basically trying to find the wing and any other missing parts we could find. There was one corner of the search grid that was sending back a visual distortion, and it was only on that corner of the search grid. We could drag the sonar fish over the F-89 and get an image, for a sonar image anyway, clear as a bell, which is what you see on our website. But when we would drag the sonar fish over that particular location of the object, we would get a visual distortion. The mystery object, as we refer to it, it was kind of strange, and we didn't know if we were having a reoccurring problem with our sonar array. So we began focusing our imaging equipment on that portion of the grid, which was several hundred feet away from the aircraft. It's still distorted. We would take the unit back to the F-89. It would not distort. We'd take the unit back over to the corner. It would distort. One of the team members recalled that F-89s were equipped at one point with nuclear weapons. This prompted us to pull everything out of the water and return to Michigan and obtain a Geiger counter. We were concerned we might be dealing with a radioactive source. We did that. We got a hold of a handheld Geiger counter, put it inside the ROV, sent the ROV to the bottom, and the results were negative. There was no radiation coming from the object.
Any speculation by you all about what is that interference? What's causing the interference?
Well, again, we thought radiation at first because it was almost a mimic of, if you've ever had a cellular phone turned on next to a computer monitor and get a phone call, you'll see it distorting in the monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we were looking at on the images that we were getting, was that sort of visual distortion. So we thought we might be dealing with some form of radiation, but we eliminated that. We still don't know. We haven't been back since with the Shark system, our big sonar array. We simply captured the images we captured on the sonar system to get what we've got. But it would be an interesting test to go back next season and use the Shark array and find out exactly what's causing that distortion.
In the side scan imaging, what can you describe in more detail about the teardrop-shaped object?
What can I tell you about it? We don't know what it is. We're not ufologists. We are divers and scientists. The ROV footage shows that it's clearly metallic. It doesn't show up on a regular magnometer scan, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. It just means it's not made out of iron. It definitely has the reflective qualities of metal, so I would call it metallic. There has been some speculation. internet that it is dented in the front. In fact, it is not dented in the front. It appears to be a distortion on the side scan image. So it's very smooth and metallic in shape and fairly large.
Could you please give some of the measurements that you know, the distance between the plane and that teardrop-shaped object and the estimated size of the teardrop-shaped object?
The distance between the two objects is approximately 212 feet, and I believe the size of the teardrop is roughly 8 feet by 15 feet, but that's just the exposed portion. We don't know what else lies beneath the sand.
And so you're saying that the teardrop itself is not more than 15 feet in diameter?
It's not diameter because it's an oblong kind of shape. From what we can tell, what's exposed is about a 15 by 8 foot section. Now, who knows what else is underneath?
Mm-hmm.
What you're seeing in the side scan is from the tail to the tip is about 15 feet. And from the absolute widest point of the teardrop across, I believe, is 8 to 10 feet, somewhere in there.
Are there any instruments that you can use that can say what this is made out of?
No. As I said, it doesn't show up on a magnometer, and that's pretty much what you're the only thing you can use without actually getting into recovering the object.
But if it doesn't have iron, it's not going to have a signature in a magnetometer?
Right. Magnetometers are essentially huge magnets. And anybody who's had a magnet knows that sometimes they attract metal, sometimes they don't. And this one does not give a reading on a magnometer.
Now, in the original story that was released from the Air Force and the media at the time, the Air Force said that there was an object identified as a UFO traveling over 500 miles an hour that the F-89 was racing toward out across Whitefish Bay, and that they watched on radar as the blips between the F-89 and the UFO that was traveling rapidly came together and joined into one blip. One of the quotes from that period of time was from the Air Force, "The blip apparently just swallowed the F-89. No trace was ever found of the missing men, the F-89, or the UFO." And that was a quote from a report.
Correct.
So you would think that whatever this object was, the blip that seemed to swallow the F-89, it would have to be bigger than an F-89.
The aircraft disappeared at 7,000 feet also. The aircraft that we found doesn't appear to have hit the lake from a fall of 7,000 feet. The wreckage that we found would certainly not suggest the plane fell from an altitude of 7,000 feet.
And so there really is a substantial mystery about what this teardrop-shaped object is down there a few hundred feet from the F-89.
Absolutely, a tremendous mystery.